So we're continuing in these early chapters of 1 Corinthians. Turn then please to that passage that we read, 1 Corinthians chapter 3, verses 10 to 20. And I want you to see how this passage works structurally, how it's arranged. And the first thing then that I want to show you is this. Notice that three times in this passage, a particular combination occurs. The phrase, if anyone, followed shortly afterwards by the word for. So verse 12, if anyone builds on the foundation with gold, silver, precious stones, wood, hay, straw, each one's work will become manifest, for the day will disclose it. That's the first occurrence. Then verse 17. And let no one deceive himself. If anyone among you thinks that he is wise in this age, let him become a fool that he may become wise for the wisdom of this world. And so on. That's the second occurrence. And then verse 18. I've jumped there. So verse 17 is the second occurrence. If anyone destroys God's temple, God will destroy him, for God's temple is holy. And then verse 18, I've already told you that one. If anyone among you thinks he is wise, for the wisdom of this world is folly. So you can hopefully see there then that there is already a threefold structure just emerging faintly in this passage if we just focus on that little combination. But I want us to go a bit further now and to bring this threefold structure then into sharper relief, because there's actually a whole complex sequence that occurs three times here, a recurring sequence that goes like this: a fact, an activity, a consequence, an explanation. Fact, activity, consequence, explanation. That's the recurring sequence. So let me show you. Look first of all at verses 10 to 15. And in verses 10 and 11, we have a fact. Jesus Christ is the foundation. Then in verse 12, we have an activity. If anyone builds. In verse 13, we have a consequence. Each one's work will become manifest. And then also in verse 13, we have an explanation, for the day will disclose it. Now look at the second paragraph, verses 16 and 17, and the sequence occurs again. In verse 16, we have a fact. The church is God's temple. Then in verse 17, we have an activity. If anyone destroys. Also in verse 17, we have a consequence. God will destroy him. And then again in verse 17, we have an explanation, for God's temple is holy. And now look at the last section of our passage, verses 18 to 20, where the sequence occurs one final time. Verse 18, we have a fact. Self-deception is a possibility. Then also in verse 18, we have an activity. If anyone thinks. Again in verse 18, we have a consequence. Let him become a fool. And then in verse 19, we have an explanation. For the wisdom of this world is folly with God. So that's a very quick whistle-stop tour, but I hope that layout at least makes a little bit of sense and that I haven't lost you completely in that. Well, I want now to consider more slowly then each occurrence of this sequence. It's difficult to know how to differentiate the three sequences for the purpose of sermon headings, but I've simply gone with those three if anyone's. If anyone builds, if anyone destroys, if anyone thinks, they will make do for our headings this evening. So first of all then, if anyone builds. If anyone builds. And here we're looking at verses 10 to 15. So the fact here, remember, is expressed in verses 10 and 11. Jesus Christ is the foundation. Jesus Christ is the foundation. That's the fact with which this paragraph begins. But what's that about? What does Paul mean when he says in verse 10, according to the grace of God given to me like a skilled master builder, I laid a foundation? What does he mean by that? Well, he's saying the same thing that he said back in chapter 2, verse 2. When he first came to Corinth, the message he preached was Jesus Christ. He didn't preach morals. He didn't preach philosophy. He didn't preach social programs. He didn't preach politics. He preached Jesus Christ. And it was that message of Jesus Christ then that had caused conversions to happen and a church of converts to come into existence. And so in that sense, Jesus Christ had been the foundation of this church. It had been founded on him. That's what Paul is saying in verses 10 and 11. By the way, the description that he gives of himself there in verse 10 isn't Paul succumbing to pride for a moment, a skilled master builder. The ESV unhelpfully conceals the loaded term that Paul uses there. It's literally like a wise master builder, not a skilled master builder, a wise master builder. Is that any different, you say? Well, yes, it is, because remember, wisdom is a key concept throughout these chapters. It will be picked up again at the end of this evening's passage. And when we recognize that, we realize, I think, that Paul isn't showing off here about what an adept church planter he is and how he'd done lots of careful research into Corinthian culture and found the best way of engaging that culture because he's such a skilled practitioner, possessing all this wealth of missiological experience and insight. He's saying the opposite, actually. He's saying, I did the dumbest, most primitive thing that one could possibly do. I preached in Corinth the undiluted message of Jesus Christ. Paul isn't claiming his approach was remotely skillful, but he's saying that in God's arrangement of things, preaching the undiluted message of Jesus Christ, although so artless and naive and unsophisticated, is actually wisdom. His wisdom. His strange, unearthly, counterintuitive wisdom. That's what he's saying when he calls himself in verse 10 a wise master builder. But you get this fact then that has been expressed here in verses 10 and 11. Jesus Christ is the foundation of the Corinthian church, and in fact, the foundation of every true church. On to the activity. The activity, of course, in this paragraph is building. If anyone builds, he says in verse 12. What's he talking about? Well, he's talking about the teaching ministry that was going on in the Corinthian church. It seems that in the earliest days of its existence, following Paul's initial planting work, the teaching ministry had been connected with Apollos. That's what Paul meant back in verse 6. Apollos watered. I planted, Apollos watered. But the building efforts of which he speaks now don't involve Apollos. Notice in verse 10 he uses the present tense. Someone else is building upon it. I laid the foundation. Someone else is building upon it. And yet we know from chapter 16 verse 12 that Apollos isn't in Corinth anymore. So this building work, this teaching ministry that he's talking about here is being practiced by others, not by Apollos, probably by the church's own homegrown leadership. That takes us on to the consequence. These men in the church engaging in this teaching ministry, here pictured as a construction project, it had a consequence. And that consequence, in a word, is accountability. It was making these men accountable. Each one's work, Paul says solemnly in verse 13, will become manifest. And specifically, what will become manifest, what these men are accountable for, is the materials that they have used. Whether gold, silver, precious stones, wood, hay, straw, verse 12. Now, that obviously suits this building imagery that Paul is using, but what does this mean in real terms? Well, two important points to note. First, we don't need to get bogged down, I think, in these six materials that Paul mentions. Clearly, they divide into two categories, good materials and bad materials. Gold, silver, and precious stones are good material for building, and wood, hay, and straw then are bad materials for building. So these men then will be accountable for whether they taught in the church good stuff or bad stuff. That then raises the question, of course, well, what's the criterion? What differentiates good teaching and bad teaching? Well, the second thing to note here is that stress in verse 12. Now, if anyone builds on the foundation with gold, silver, precious stones, etc. On the foundation, I think that's the clue as to what differentiates good teaching and bad teaching. Good teaching is consistent with the foundation. Bad teaching is not consistent with the foundation. I mean, think of an actual building. Think of the restoration project going on at the Notre Dame Cathedral there in Paris, where that terrible fire raged a couple of years ago. And of course, a good bit of that cathedral remains standing. It wasn't altogether burned up by any means. The builders, in carrying out their restoration project, they're not starting from scratch. Rather, they're building onto a structure that is already there in parts. And they're going to do so then in a way that's consistent with what's already there. If what's already there comprises grand medieval stone, then they're not going to add to that using modern concrete breeze blocks or corrugated sheets that they bought from Wix. No, they're going to use grand medieval stone or something as close to that as they can get. They're going to aim for as much similarity as possible to what their predecessors put in place all those centuries earlier. And in the same way, Paul, in planting this church, had taught Christ. And so all those who followed him with a teaching ministry there should aim for the closest possible similarity. They too should teach Christ. And that then is what the teachers in that church and the teachers in every church are accountable for. Teaching Christ. Which takes us to the explanation. Remember the sequence: fact, activity, consequence, explanation. How are the teachers in Corinth and the teachers in every church accountable? How does this accountability work? Well, the explanation's there in verse 13, for the day will disclose it. The day, of course, is the last day, the second coming, the culmination of history. At that time, Paul is saying, the ministries of Christian teachers will be scrutinized on this basis. Was Christ the content? Was Christ the content? He goes on, doesn't he, to talk about some whose teaching on the last day will be burned up. It was all stories and jokes. Or it was all folksy advice about how to be a nice person. Or it was all a big rant about the errors of the Charismatics and the Arminians and the Roman Catholics. It wasn't dominated by the eternal deity and the assumed humanity and the sin-bearing death and the epoch-changing resurrection and the cosmic lordship and the world-ending return and the supreme loveliness and the consummate worthiness and the all-surpassing beauty of Jesus Christ. And some of the teachers who thus fail to teach Christ may, in their own hearts, actually have had saving faith in Jesus, Paul says. And if so, they will be saved on that day, Paul is clear. They will be saved, Paul says in verse 15, as through fire. Now, he's not saying that such men will have to face a dose of hell on their way into the heavenly kingdom. The fire in these verses doesn't represent hell. It's the fire by which God tests things to see if they are genuine or not. He isn't saying that they'll face a dose of hell, but he is saying that it will be a big deal for those men having to watch their ministries go up in smoke on that last day, exposed as worthless because they weren't Christ-centered ministries. That will be for them, Paul is saying, not a damning moment, but a hugely sobering moments. And what should we take from all of this then in this first paragraph? From this first fact, activity, consequence, explanation sequence in our passage? Well, perhaps just this. Pray. Pray. Pray for the elders of this church as we exercise our teaching responsibilities. And in that sense, engage in the building work that Paul is talking about here. Pray that our materials would be the gold silver and precious stones that is Jesus Christ. Pray indeed for all those you know who teach within God's church, that Christ would be the theme of their teaching. Pray for churches you know, that they will be exposed always to the kind of teaching that on the last day will survive the fire of God's testing. Pray about such things. And so that's the first thing this evening, if anyone builds. Secondly, if anyone destroys. If anyone destroys. And now we're looking then at verses 16 and 17. So the fact in these verses is the church is God's temple. The church is God's temple. The church is God's temple, Paul says in verse 16, for a very specific reason. It's a divine residence. That, of course, is what made the temple in Old Testament days. God dwelt in it. And God dwells in the church. God the Spirit does. A Christian church is inhabited by God the Spirit. We mustn't confuse this with what Paul says later on in this letter in chapter 6. There he talks about the individual believer being a temple in which the Spirit resides. What he says here is a different point. He's saying that a church, a body of men and women in a particular place who have bound themselves to one another as a family to worship Christ together and to grow together through the Word of God and the sacraments and all under the oversight of elders, a church is in its own special way a temple in which the Spirit resides. It's an extraordinary truth when you think about it in relation to this city of Corinth. Corinth boasted several very eminent temples. You remember our series in chapters 8 to 10 a little while ago now. And Paul's dismay there about Christian believers in that city paying visits to the city's temples. You see, both architecturally and culturally, they were a huge feature, these temples of this city. And yet, do you see what Paul is saying here? He's saying the only temple in Corinth that really matters is no imposing building situated in one of the city's main streets. It's rather a motley bunch of men and women sitting around a living room in some very ordinary suburban house. That's the temple that matters. That's the only setting in Corinth where a genuine divine person actually resides. You are God's temple, he says to the Corinthian believers, and God's Spirit dwells in you. And he would say exactly the same thing were he able to stand at this lectern this evening. He would say the same thing of NREC. So that's the fact. On to the activity. And the activity in this paragraph then is destroying. If anyone destroys, he says in verse 17. He's referring, again, it seems, to the jealousy and strife that he mentioned back in verse 3 of this chapter. Remember, we said that this was the atmosphere in which this whole I follow Paul, I follow Apollos thing was taking place. It wasn't a bit of gentlemanly sport. It was fiercely tribal in its character. And it doesn't seem to have happened yet, but in Paul's mind, there's this very real risk that the fault lines between the different groups in that church could become so deep and wide that the church simply disintegrates. It breaks up. The Paul faction within the Corinthian church becomes a church in its own right, and the Apollos faction within the Corinthian church becomes a church in its own right. Paul can foresee things getting to that point, that tragic point, if the present trajectory continues. And he says here then that if that happens, the instigators of it will have done something monumentally serious. They will have done something which no old covenant Israelite would ever have dreamt of doing. No old covenant Israelite, however frustrated or insubordinate or even deranged he might have been, would ever have gotten up one morning, fetched a sledgehammer from his shed, headed off through Jerusalem streets to the temple, and there proceeded to take great swipes at the walls of that building. It was unthinkable. You wouldn't ever, ever make even a small attempt to destroy God's temple if you were an old covenant Israelite. But when anyone in a new covenant context assaults the unity of a Christian church and contributes through jealousy and strife and such behaviours to a church disintegrating, breaking up, that's what's happening. That person is destroying God's temple. It takes us on to the consequence, and the consequence of this kind of destructive behaviour is expressed in verse 17 in four very stark words: God will destroy him. God will destroy him. God will destroy that person whose troublemaking has destroyed his temple. It can only be a reference to eternal damnation, a reference to hell. As for the explanation, it's at the end of verse 17 there. For God's temple is holy. I talked on Christmas morning about that literary term, tautology. Tautology is where you have two terms in a phrase which mean the same thing, so that the inclusion of both isn't really necessary. A dilapidated ruin was one example I gave that morning. Something that's dilapidated is by definition a ruin, of course. And the phrase God's temple is holy is almost in that category, isn't it? As God's temple, then by definition it's holy. Paul doesn't really even need to add the adjective there. But Paul wants us to get the point. He wants us to see why it is that destroying the temple that is God's church by behaving divisively incurs nothing less than damnation. You know, I have a feeling that we don't tend in the evangelical church today to take divisive behavior in the Church of Jesus Christ anything like seriously enough. Do you remember Paul's words that never cease to amaze me in Titus 3 verse 10, right at the end of that letter? Paul says, warn a divisive person once, and then warn him a second time. After that, have nothing to do with him. Tremendously strong words. To the divisive person, the divisive person. And the reason then that we don't take it seriously enough is precisely that we don't have this high view of the church that's expressed here in our passage. That it's God's temple. May none of us ever be contributors to the destruction of a temple of the living God. The frightening thing is that this sin can so easily be packaged as something else. If you engage in sexual immorality, then usually there are no two ways about it. You've engaged in sexual immorality. But if you destroy God's temple, that can be packaged, can't it, as being ever so valiant for the truth. Being someone who's principled and won't compromise. And that's scary. It's scary that a sin God takes as seriously as he's expressing here in our passage is amenable to being repackaged in that way. Let's guard ourselves very, very carefully indeed that none of us are ever those who contribute to the destruction of a temple of the living God. So if anyone builds, if anyone destroys, and then thirdly, if anyone thinks, and here we're looking at verses 18 to 20, and the fact here is this: self-deception is a possibility. Self-deception is a possibility. That's clear from the first part of verse 18 there. Let no one deceive himself. That is to say, you can convince yourself of something that is completely wrong. You can convince yourself of something that is completely wrong. And the activity in these verses is an example of self-deception. It's thinking, if anyone thinks, verse 18, but specifically then, a professing Christian thinking of himself as wise because he meets the world's criteria when it comes to wisdom. So in terms of our context then, you're a professing Christian, but over time you start to live your life increasingly with self-fulfillment as your goal, grasping as much as you can in the way of wealth and possessions and success and all that kind of thing. And as you do that then, many people you know, people who belong to this world, affirm you in this way that you're living. They regard you as being really wise. You only live once after all. Get as much as you can for yourself while you have the chance. And as the world then takes that stance toward you and affirms this lifestyle that increasingly you're gravitating towards and regards you as being really wise, you start to think of yourself in those terms also. And you start to think of yourself as being really quite wise. And that's the self-deception then that Paul is saying in this passage is a serious and a grave possibility. As for the consequence, well, the consequence there in verse 18 is that action is needed. Action is needed if you're in that position, if you're that professing Christian who's starting to think of yourself as wise because the world's regarding you as wise, because you're living the way that the world lives, then action is needed, a U-turn is needed. Let him become a fool, that he may become wise. Become a fool, that is, in the world's perception, in order that you may be truly wise. And then the explanation is given in verse 19. For the wisdom of this world is folly with God. At first sight, that sentence just seems like it's kind of very similar stuff to what Paul was writing back in chapter 1. And it is similar stuff to what Paul was writing back in chapter 1. But there's also a twist there. Because back in chapter 1, Paul's point was that God's wisdom is folly with this world. God's wisdom is the cross, and that's folly in this world's eyes. Now he's turning that round, and he's saying the world's wisdom is folly in God's eyes. The world's wisdom is folly in God's eyes. Living for self-fulfillment, living to get as much as you can for yourself and be successful for the 70 that you have, that the world thinks is such a wise course of action in God's eyes, that is folly. And that's why, if you're being drawn in that direction, you need to take the U-turn of verse 18. You need to become a fool and realize that what the world regards as utter foolishness, namely living not for yourself, but living for someone else and becoming the slave of Jesus Christ. And that's what Paul's going to talk about in the next section that we'll come to, God willing, next Lord's Day evening. Just surrendering yourself as a slave to this master Jesus Christ, which the world just sees as so utterly ridiculous. That's what you need to do, Paul is saying. If you're being drawn into the world's wisdom, and you're deceiving yourself that you really are being wise, wake up, Paul is saying. Realize that that is folly in God's sight, and become wise by becoming a slave of Jesus Christ, however foolish that may be in the world's eyes. Notice the language of verse 20, Paul's quoting there from Psalm 94. The Lord knows the thoughts of the wise, that they are futile. You may be being deceived. God isn't being deceived. He sees through it. He sees how foolish the world's philosophy is, the world's idea of living for oneself. Make sure you're not fooled. And the application there then for us is obvious tonight. We do live in a world, don't we, where it is so easy to just very slowly, by very small steps, almost imperceptibly, very easy to be molded into the world's idea of what's wise, the world's idea of what a sane and a healthy lifestyle looks like. Let's not be conned. Let's not deceive ourselves. But let's be those who, for all its apparent folly, just throw ourselves at the feet of Jesus. I'm living for you and for your glory, not for me and mine. May God help us to be like that. Amen. Let's pray. Our